and pattern. The lifeless, low-hanging clouds had costumed the most important part of all. In such light, with nothing casting shadows, he looked just like a red. Just like Max. A shudder of fear seized him, and Dory squatted down. He cupped his hands together just over the ground, trying to make a pocket of space between his palms and the street, small enough that even without the sun there was a contrast, and he could see. Yes. His shadow was still there. When he stood up, neither Amadi or Malik laughed. They understood. Amadi grabbed the back of Ori's neck firmly in comfort, the only place that wasn't covered in lines of paint. It was the closest thing she could give him to a hug without smudging his disguise. "Still there," he said. His chest ached. He wanted to grab her back and hold tight, but he couldn't, because of the red paint, and because of Max.
"You make sure the general comes back," Nuz said desperately. "Make sure both of you do."
At the library, it was chaos. Frantic Reds were pouring out of the front doors, their arms full of books, waiting desperately for Iowan troops to arrive, and panicking as to why they yet hadn't. The big man was there as usual, but so was another Red whom Ori had never seen before. A woman who looked to be in her 50s or 60s, with streaks of red braided throughout her wild, silvered hair. She'd wrapped herself in a crimson sheet not unlike a toga. One small limp breast hung carelessly out as she snatched at the other Reds. Then a pristine white shape appeared from behind the Iowa's deserted barricade line. Emmanuel. There was a momentary lull as the Reds recalibrated. Everything paused. Books froze mid-air. Then the woman turned to screech at him. Somehow, almost impossibly, the Reds seemed to still remember him as the Iowa's leader. They swarmed forward, dumping books at his feet, as many as he wanted, practically burying him. Emmanuel scooped up copy after copy, trying to quickly choose which to stuff into the precious extra space in his medical bag. He pointed toward the building, miming his question, asking to be taken deeper into the Red King's library, to choose the book he wanted. He picked up a book, pointed at it, and pointed again toward the building as the Reds screamed. Ori watched from his perch atop the roof of a destroyed public bathroom. The Reds were dragging out bigger and bigger books now, misunderstanding that size didn't determine worth the way it did with food, weapons, armies. Across the distance, Ori could see Emmanuel searching the growing pile to see if they'd accidentally thrown to him the one he wanted most of all. "Push them as far as you can," Ori thought. "Bring as many back as possible." The older woman and the big man were growing more agitated. Then an angry bellow erupted from within the darkened building, causing everyone to duck on instinct. The Red King was finished guessing. Everything went still as he emerged, glittering silvery maroon in the weak hail as he came right into the center of the street. Ori was too far to make out any of his features, but even from that distance, the Red King was terrifying. Ori didn't know what he had looked like before he lost his shadow, but what the Red King had become now was a living mountain. He had thought the Big Red was huge, but now, compared to his master, he was minuscule. The Red King was the size of two men, over 10 feet tall, wearing a scarlet cloak of 100 layers, and haphazard armor made from whole, bent steel doors. A human skull could fit inside each scarred crimson hand. Red dripped off him from everywhere, leaving trails behind him. Emmanuel raised his arms. Ori couldn't tell if he was trying to smile or grimacing in terror. The Red King roared again, held out his palms. They were also covered in red, but a wetter red, red that came from inside a body. The pregnant woman was in real danger. Emmanuel took a step forward hesitantly. The Red King grabbed him with one hand and dragged him in like a rag doll. "Do it, Ori," Max said in Ori's mind, the same way he always imagined it before he had to kick open an abandoned Arlington door or go into a deserted shop, to give him courage.
He clung to it fiercely now, the memory of the sound of her voice. Go! He ran with everything he had, as fast and quietly as he could. The Reds were all still fixated on their leader as they escorted him and Emmanuel in, some excited, some entranced. Ori skirted the outside of the crowd, hoping he looked like just another eager warrior, past the rubble, into the courtyard, up the stairs, through the darkness of the doors. He was in. Hide, Ori, Max's voice urged again. He ducked behind the first set of shelves he saw, and waited for his eyes to adjust to the light. Overhead, a few books glided between the rafters of the library in slow circles. Mournful birds separated from their flock, pages fluttering like wings. The Red King and Emmanuel entered, flanked by crimson warriors. Across the main lobby, the pregnant woman was still there where Ori had seen her last, still swollen with child, still in pain. But now there was much more blood. Much more. She was pale with fatigue, the skin of her trembling lips almost gray. The longer Ori watched her from behind the bookcase, the more he didn't know how much Emmanuel could do for her without a hospital. In fact, it seemed like it would be almost nothing. Even if she still had the strength to push, too much could go wrong. Ori couldn't understand how Emmanuel thought he was going to save her. Or get the book. He isn't, Ori. He refused to believe Max's voice. He refused to believe that Emmanuel had come only to see Paul's book one last time, and never hoped to make it out anyway. Surely his life was worth more than this, one pointless, unwinnable quest. So is staying here to look for me, her voice said. But the Red Woman's wailing drowned it out. The procession began to lumber past Ori's hiding place then. First, the Red King swept farther inward, dragging layers and layers of red cloaks, velvet curtains, and Afghan rugs stacked on top of one another beneath his armor. It looked so heavy, Ori couldn't believe he could still stand under their weight. Then the rest of the Reds came, panicked, hopeful, ushering a trembling Emmanuel deeper inside. The woman cried again as they reached her, and Ori scooted back for more cover, deeper into the tangled maze of wood and books. Baby, he heard Emmanuel say, to see if even though they could no longer speak, perhaps they understood. The word seemed to do nothing. The Red King roared. Find the book, Max told Ori. He turned around and peered into the nightmarish forest of shelves. Find the book for Emmanuel, and then save him while there's still time, before the woman dies. He crept deeper into the library. The stacks twisted, some dead-ending, some spiraling back on themselves, some too tightly packed to squeeze through. He tried to work his way towards signs still hanging on the walls, hoping for directions to different sections and genres, but every time he heard a red, he had to divert behind another overturned bookcase or sideways shelf to hide, getting more and more lost. Hurry, Max's voice whispered to him. Find the book before it's too late. Ori glanced back, and through two half-empty shelves, glimpsed Emmanuel, his lab coat already stained with blood, his tools emptied out all around him, trying desperately to hold the woman still so he could try something, anything. She wailed, delirious, clawing at her bare belly. Blood was smeared on the floor all around her. Then there it was, the sign near the back on the wall. Poetry. Ori scrambled faster, heart racing, as the Red Woman's scream shattered the room again, but this time it was different. There was death in the scream. Turn back, Max whispered suddenly. There's no time. He ignored her and threw himself against the shelf, nose pressed against hundreds of musty spines, searching for the W names. Paul Jeremiah West. Paul Jeremiah West. Paul Jeremiah West. Ori, Max begged in his head. He found the W's all near the bottom. Wallace, Walter, Webb, Wepford, White. No, he breathed. The seconds were racing by. He checked again, but there was nothing. Nothing in the space between Wepford and White. It wasn't there. Uri leaned closer. On the spines of the books on either side of where Paul's should have been, there were old stains, the streaks long dried, as if someone had come to this exact place and sorted through, looking for something in particular. Someone covered in red.
Yes, Emmanuel shouted then from far across the library.
Uri jerked back toward the sound and peered through the fractured shelves. The Red King had pulled something small and rectangular out of the jagged angles of his armor, and held it toward Emmanuel as a last, desperate offering to stop the woman's pain and save her life. A book.
No, Uri thought.
The cover came into view as the Red King reached down to hand it over.
No.
But it was. Paul's poetry. Uri stared, transfixed, as Emmanuel reached for it, and the Red King roared back at him. It was impossible. How could the Red King have known the exact book they had been looking for all this time without being able to read it? But he didn't have time to consider it further. The Red Woman's breath shuddered weakly.
Run, Uri, Max urged again. Get out!
Then the whole room collapsed into a deafening roar.
Too late, Max whispered.
No, he tried to argue, but he knew. The woman is dead. The red screams became a war call. Something bright and hot whizzed by Uri's head and smashed into the bookshelf beside him. Fire. They were setting everything on fire. They were going to burn it all down.
Emmanuel! Uri yelled as he came careening around the shelves.
Everywhere, reds were running wildly. The woman was still on the floor, unmoving. He couldn't see Emmanuel or the Red King through the chaos.
Emmanuel!
He spotted them through the gathering crowd. He shoved between the vicious, crazed reds running for the far end of the room, where the Red King and Emmanuel were sliding on the blood-soaked floor, strangling each other, both scrambling for a weapon. Uri was so close he could almost touch them, when the Red King's crimson hand wrapped around a shard of broken glass. He was so close, he could see the Red King in all his horrifying glory for the first time. So close, he could see his face as the serrated tool sang through the air.
No!
Emmanuel screamed. Everything froze. Uri didn't know if it was because Emmanuel knew he couldn't stop the blade, or because he suddenly realized that Uri was there, where Emmanuel had begged him not to be. He understood now why his friend had been so afraid for him to join the Iowa's missions, and why all of the Shadowless were so obsessed with books. Because if it was true that every Shadowless got to keep one thing to cling to until the very end, one thing that would eventually be all there was left of them, until everything was gone, and that being together under a powerful leader helped them remember longer what little they still had, then only one thing made sense. Uri did not want to believe it, but he was there, and it was too late. He saw. The Red King was Paul.
No!
Emmanuel cried again. The jagged shard plunged into him, and the sound snapped off into a horrible gasp. Blood spurted everywhere in a surging river, until both he and the Red King looked the same. Uri ran at them, his voice echoing off the walls as he lunged.
Paul!
He screamed. The Red King let go of Emmanuel's body and turned. It was impossible to tell if it was simply because of the sound, or if that word was the last word that could catch fire in his mind. Uri wanted to see the answer in his eyes as he descended upon him, but he searched. Even as he pulled the DC police issue Glock 13 that Malik had given him, out of the belt of his pants and aimed. He searched and saw nothing. There was only red. Uri had heard their soldiers tell each other legends that the Red King was unkillable, that he'd forgotten he wasn't immortal, so he was. But it wasn't true. He had forgotten his name, that he had written poetry, that he was not the size of a rhinoceros, that Emmanuel was a person he once loved, not feared and hated. but he had not yet forgotten that he could die. "Is it done?" Emmanuel asked him, as Ori crouched down to him. The gun smoked in his hand, emptied of the same fatal storm that had possessed his lost shotgun. Thunder moaned softly, fading in time with the last shuddering beats of the Red King's life. All around them, the shocked, disbelieving screams began. "It's done," Ori said.
"I told you not to come," he repeated faintly.
His eyes were glazed.
"I know,"
Ori said softly. He put a hand gently under Emmanuel's head.
"I didn't want,"
Emmanuel rasped,
"you to know."
"It doesn't matter," Ori said. "You got the book." The book was Paul. Not that. That had never been.
"Book," he repeated.
Ori took it from where it lay beside Emmanuel, still wrapped in a tattered plastic bag he must have brought from the Iowa to protect it. There was so much blood Ori could barely see. He pressed his hand to Emmanuel's neck to try to stanch the place he thought the enraged, throbbing flood was leaving his body, but it didn't help. The wounds were too deep. He tried to pick Emmanuel up, but Emmanuel was too weak to help him lift. They sank back to the floor as the Reds began to crowd around them.
"Go,"
Emmanuel said, but Ori shook his head. The Reds converged. He couldn't move. He couldn't leave Emmanuel. Suddenly, Amadee was there, slapping his face, trying to bring him out of his shock. Ori looked up to see Malik hoisting up the other side of Emmanuel's limp, pallid body. They'd broken the general's order, too. They had come.
"Retreat!"
The world snapped back into focus as Malik shouted the command at him over and over.
"Retreat!"
Ori's feet were somehow already obeying before he'd even understood the words, running as they carried Emmanuel together toward the open doors. Behind, he could hear the blunt punch of arrow shafts through flesh as Amadee killed the Reds that followed, one after another.
"I can't stop the bleeding,"
Ori yelled to Malik. His fingers scrambled at Emmanuel's neck. He could feel Emmanuel feebly trying to guide him with his own hands, to show him where to push to stop the blood from pouring out of him.
"He's so calm,"
Ori thought hysterically as he tried to choke the hot syrupy liquid without cutting off Emmanuel's air. "How can he be so calm?" Most of the walls were on fire then, cracking in the sweltering heat. Rocks split against the floor around their feet as the Reds hurled them. Ori wanted to cover his head, but there was no way. He just kept running as fast as he could without dropping Emmanuel, praying that nothing would land on them.
"Ori,"
Emmanuel coughed.
"The book."
"I still have it,"
Ori yelled to make sure Emmanuel could hear him.
"I have it, don't worry."
He did have it, just barely, pinched between his biceps and rib as he tried to keep it there and support Emmanuel's slackening weight. If Ori dropped him, the Reds would be on them before they could pick him up again. If he dropped the book, they'd lose it forever. Malik would never let them stop for it. As if he could read Ori's mind, Emmanuel's hands grew tighter around his wrist.
"If you can't carry both,"
he managed to choke out.
"Take book."
The One Who Gathers. 2 months after Dr. Zadeh was killed, someone in New Orleans forgot that the electrical grid had been destroyed in the initial panicked riots, and the power in the city suddenly came back, although the system wasn't quite the same as before. This time, instead of a generator in a factory, the wires just met and shot off in a tangle into the sky, to retrieve energy from passing storms, so no one had to service them. Inconsistent, but at least functional. Apparently far more than most cities had. According to the old man the amnesiac rescued from the abandoned bus station he'd chosen to die in, both San Diego and Oklahoma City now hopped. Portions of the cities, from single buildings, roads, neighborhoods, to entire zip codes, rose between inches and several stories into the air at random times, then settled again. It was probably someone's terror of earthquakes that brought it about. The old man had left California after his son slipped during a hop and fell to his death. If only the Shadowless could have forgotten that seismic movement existed, instead of that cities couldn't jump in defense.
"Are you the leader here?"
the old man asked him, lifting his bald, leathered head from the pillow. He coughed weakly.
"Of New Orleans or of this facility?" "You should think about the hurricanes," the old man continued, ignoring the question. "Something should be done about the hurricanes before the season hits. Don't wait until one is already here."
The amnesiac watched him shiver through his fever as he slept in one of the many empty beds, trying to imagine all the fantastical iterations a hurricane could evolve into, all the twisted interpretations of human desire to stop a deadly storm that there were, both possible and impossible. The old man's breath was fluttering, uneven.
"Is he going to die?"
Buddy asked. The amnesiac turned and looked at the young Shadowless in the doorway from his place beside the old man.
"I think so," he said, "probably before morning. He's very weak."
Buddy pushed an unruly shock of hair off his forehead. The amnesiac had found him a month ago. It was more dangerous now, but he still tried to continue Dr. Zade's work when he could.
"Such a shame," he sighed. "Still has his shadow and everything." "You're doing well, though?"
"Yeah," Buddy said. But it wasn't really an answer. Just a noncommittal sound one would make to fill their turn in a conversation they weren't really listening to. He was still staring longingly at the thin, dark copy of the old man's bony arm where it lay, draped over the sheet. It had been a long time since they'd had another shadow in the assisted living facility, besides the amnesiac's own. Everyone but him had either died or lost theirs. It was strange to share all the blank space on the walls with the old man's withered silhouette.
"Such a shame," Buddy murmured again absently.
"Buddy," the amnesiac said.
"Buddy."
"Yeah?"
"Where are the others?"
For a moment, the amnesiac thought he was going to say, "What others?" But Buddy finally blinked, pulling himself out of his trance.
"The rain. Marie said from the clouds that she thinks the storm isn't far off. She said we can't wait any longer. We have to go into the storage basement now."
They stood in the small center courtyard, looking up into the roiling, sinking sky.
"See? When they look like that, a hurricane is a day out. Maybe less," Marie said as she lowered the finger she'd been pointing. They no longer called her Nurse Marie, just Marie, because she was not a nurse. Not since she had forgotten she was one, when her shadow left too. She was chewing on the corner of her lip as she pointed, because she was proud she still remembered how to read the clouds, and was trying not to smile. The rest of the Shadowless stood behind them, all 20.
"Can you tell how bad it'll be?"
the amnesiac asked her.
"Bad, I think," she said. "Maybe not quite Katrina bad, but bad."
"Who's Katrina?"
Buddy asked. Marie flexed her wrist so her palm flashed at him, as if to gently scoot away the question. The Shadowless at the facility had started to do that among themselves, when one had forgotten something that wasn't worth explaining. A kind of gentle shorthand to mean, "Don't worry about it, it doesn't matter."
"How much time do we have?" the amnesiac asked.
"None,"
Curly said. He pulled his namesake into a stumpy ponytail and bound it to keep the strands away from his face.
"By the time we finish moving all the food and supplies into the storage basement to wait this out, it'll practically be here."
"Wait it out," Marie sighed. "If it's a hurricane, fine. But it might not be a hurricane once it reaches us. It might be the memory of one."
"I know," the amnesiac said quietly. "But what else can we do?"
Will it be... it? Buddy asked. The end?
We survived the riots, he replied. He put a hand on Buddy's shoulder. And the exterminators, and starvation. A lot of things.
Yeah, but those...
Buddy frowned, struggling for words. The amnesiac tried to judge whether it was fear or shadowlessness that was making it difficult, but he couldn't tell. He wished Dr. Zadeh was still with them.
Those things were new. No one could forget them because they hadn't existed before. A hurricane is different.
Okay, enough. It's bad, but it's still coming. We need to take care of what we can do before we sit around and worry about what we can't, Downtown said. Not her real name, of course, only where they had found her. She thought the nickname would tell her more about herself than whatever her real name had been, and so it stuck. More and more of the Shadowless had started renaming themselves like that, to remind themselves of the most important things.
Okay, the amnesiac said. Let's do this quickly. Food, water, blankets, clothes, medicine. I'll get our patient files. Go in groups. Everyone, remind everyone what you're all doing. Like we practiced. Keep reminding.
Keep reminding, Buddy crowed.
Everyone splintered into small groups of three or four, darting off down different hallways.
Food, main hall, Marie called as her group scrambled toward the cafeteria, the items they needed to retrieve, and the place to take them.
Food, main hall,
the person behind her repeated.
Blankets, main hall,
Downtown's voice echoed from another corridor. Each person repeated their team's phrase after the one in front of them said it, a circular chorus. As they all vanished into the assisted living facility's other wings, the words blurred until it sounded more like a song being played from far away. In Dr. Zadeh's darkened office, his research lay in neat stacks on his desk. The amnesiac took his leather bag from the hook on the back of the door and began to file the folders into it. Downtown, F. Nurse Marie, F. Curly, M. Buddy, M. The handwritten labels flicked past as he slid each bundle into place. Some of the files were thicker than others. Some had only one sheet. It depended on at what point they had found each shadowless, how much they had left that he or Dr. Zadeh could record as potential data, research for a cure that would never be finished now, but at least they could use them as a record of who each of them had once been. They'd never be able to recover what Downtown's real name was, but at least her file could tell her that she hated carrots and was 43 years old. At the bottom, the oldest file, far thicker than the rest. The amnesiac's eyes caught on the label. It had once said one thing, then been scratched out and rewritten, then scratched out and rewritten again, until there was almost no room. He smiled and shook his head. Dr. Zadeh had tried earnestly to keep up with whatever nickname for the amnesiac had come into fashion among the Alzheimer's residents, and then later the shadowless patients, until finally he'd run out of white space on his tiny label and given up in an exasperated sputter of tiny capital letters. The amnesiac read his cramped scrawl and smiled, but it was not a happy smile. He felt his shoulders slump. He put the file into the leather bag and sat down in the doctor's dusty chair. Gajarajan, M. For a few minutes, it felt like Dr. Zadeh might walk through the door again at any moment. Then it felt like the amnesiac had been sitting there wishing he could see him one more time, for years. Finally, he stood up and went to the far corner, where a much smaller table sat by a window. A heavy binder rested atop it. The amnesiac had kept working on his own research, at least, even if he couldn't complete Dr. Zadeh's. His copy of Hemu's notebook was probably four times as thick now as when Hemu's doctor first gifted it to him. He didn't mean to, but it was hard to resist. He found his fingers flipping through the familiar pages, articles and snippets he knew backwards and forwards. In the middle, he stopped on a torn-out scene from an old play. Peter Pan.
written in 1904 by a man named J.M. Barry. Mrs. Darling, making sure that Michael does not hear. The first time was a week ago. It was Nana's night out, and I had been drowsing here by the fire when suddenly I felt a draft, as if the window were open. I looked round, and I saw that boy in the room.
Mr. Darling. In the room?
Mrs. Darling. I screamed. Just then Nana came back, and she at once sprang at him. The boy leapt for the window. She pulled down the sash quickly, but was too late to catch him.
Mr. Darling, who knows he would not have been too late?
I thought so.
Mrs. Darling.
Wait, the boy escaped, but his shadow had not time to get out. Down came the window and cut it clean off.
Mr. Darling, heavily.
Mary, Mary, why didn't you keep that shadow?
Mrs. Darling, scoring.
I did. I rolled it up, George, and here it is.
She produces it from a drawer. They unroll and examine the flimsy thing, which is not more material than a puff of smoke, and if let go, would probably float into the ceiling without discoloring it. Yet it has human shape.
Mr. Darling, it is nobody I know, but he does look a scoundrel.
Mrs. Darling,
I think he comes back to get his shadow, George.
A scoundrel.
The amnesiac smiled. He knew why Hamu had saved this clipping among the rest of his far more serious, desperate research, as silly and unhelpful as it was, because it was so charming. If only shadows were actual objects that could be touched or rolled up in drawers like pieces of paper. The amnesiac sighed. If only it was all that simple. He closed the binder before he read any more, lest he lose track of time. The pale, solemn face on the cover stared back at him, dark eyes hovering over the long, hanging trunk. He put it on top and zipped up the leather bag as he ducked out.
Water, main hall!
The faint music reached the amnesiac as he passed the main room again on the way to the infirmary.
Water, main hall!
Thunder shattered outside, booming through the facility, and a few startled screams chirped down the hallways.
Good job, everyone! The amnesiac yelled as loudly as he could. Do as much as you can and get to the main hall quickly!
Food, main hall!
He heard Marie shout back, trying to spur herself and her teammates on.
Infirmary, main hall,
he said to himself, turning into the tiled room with a row of beds.
Old man, time to go.
Water,
the old man whispered.
We have plenty, but we have to go downstairs to get it. Can you walk?
The old man blinked dazedly.
I think I'm dying, he finally said. Too much. Push too hard.
The amnesiac hefted the leather bag higher onto his shoulder. The old man was fairly tall, but weighed almost nothing now.
Can you sit? He asked. If you can sit, I think I can get you into a position where I can carry you.
The old man tried to sit. He struggled up onto his elbows, arms shivering. Bravely, he grasped the side of the bed with one skeletal hand and pulled.
Easy,
the amnesiac said. He looped one arm through each of the leather bag's short straps, so it was stuck against the front of him like a backpack worn on the wrong side.
I'm going to gently lay you over my back. Ready?
Maybe you should just leave me here,
the old man said.
I don't think it'll be long.
Trust me, you don't want to be up here, the amnesiac said.
The rain had started to thrash the roof overhead.
If you're going to die tonight, you want to go in a dry, warm place with someone sitting next to you. I've done this a lot here, seen people off. It's better to go in company, even if you only met them yesterday.
You're a good man,
he wheezed.
Maybe. The amnesiac shrugged.
I don't remember.
In the main hallway, all the groups had converged, each carrying or dragging boxes. The storm hurled rain against the east wall,
startling them all into a crouch for a moment. The amnesiac counted quickly.
Everyone's here. Okay, let's go. Basement! Basement! Basement!
They all revised the chant. Marie held a wooden torch she'd made and lit somewhere to help them through the dark hallways.
Boxes began to scrape across the floor, out toward the central atrium garden, where the storm doors to the basement were. Just as the amnesiac turned to follow last, something banged against the front lobby door.
Shit! He gasped. He stumbled, recovered, barely keeping the old man on his back.
Are you all right? He asked softly.
Yeah,
the old man gasped.
Someone's out there.
Don't! Marie hissed across the room. Don't open it!
Shadowed scavengers? More shadowless? The storm throwing debris? The amnesiac watched the locks rattle, praying they would hold. Outside, the wind was howling, strong enough that he could hear the echoes of it through the concrete walls. The door banged again.
Please!
Someone cried, a woman's voice.
Please, is someone there? Help me! The storm!
The wind swallowed whatever she said after that.
Trappers, downtown said. Or kidlings, or could be death kites circling her. We can't be sure.
Curly was next to him.
We're out of time.
They're right, he thought. Just go, keep the others safe. That was his job, what he had promised Dr. Zadeh he would do. To keep them together, to watch over them all, and to help them remember as long as he could. He listened to the woman outside pound her fists on the door and wail. The trees were likely bent sideways by now, everything left in the city leaning as if being devoured by a giant vacuum in the sky. The trappers used all manner of bait. Children, women, puppies they'd stolen from a street dog. Kidlings didn't use bait at all. They were so terrible they didn't have to. The amnesiac had watched the old man moan in the bus station for 4 hours yesterday, before he was sure no one had planted him there. He couldn't give this woman the same test. She'd be ripped away by the raging wind in far less time. But he couldn't just leave her to die, either.
I'm sorry, he finally yelled. We can't open the door. Go somewhere else while you still have time.
Hello?
She screamed. The door rattled as she hit her fists against it.
Dr. Zadeh, is that you?
Dr. Zadeh. They all took a step back. The amnesiac looked at Marie, who now was staring suspiciously at the door. Without the signs on the building any longer, there was only one explanation. Whoever knew this had been Dr. Zadeh's clinic, had known him personally.
What now?
Marie whispered. I don't know, the amnesiac said. He shrugged the leather bag until the strap slid off his arms and it plopped to the ground, and then carefully laid the old man over Curly's back. He couldn't fight holding it all. He motioned for Marie to give him her knife.
Are we really doing this? She asked.
Are you shadowless?
The amnesiac called at the door, gripping the blade as tightly as he could.
No, I have a shadow. I have a shadow.
The woman outside scraped desperately at the wood as the wind shrieked.
Let me in.
Then what's your name?
He yelled. Not that the amnesiac would remember anyone from more than just a few weeks before the forgetting, but it was all he could think of.
What's your name? If you still have your shadow, you should remember your name.
She shouted her answer frantically. He couldn't hear the first word through the wind. But the second one he finally caught as she screamed it over and over.
Avanthika!
She cried.
Avanthika!
He didn't realize what he had done until it was over. He was across the room at the locks. He opened the door, reached out into the cold slicing rain, grabbed the ragged thing hunched against the wind, and yanked it inside in one motion. Marie's torch snarled, angry at being whipped by the wet air. The amnesiac pressed the knife down on his captive before she could recover.
Prove it, he said. I'm sorry, but you have to prove it. I have people I have to protect.
You,
she stammered. The shadowless were shouting now, some excited, some terrified. It was too dark to see more than the lines on the stranger's dirty face, her bony hands, the wisp of her shadow pinned beneath her on the floor.
Prove it, the amnesiac said again. How did he die?
Not Dr. Zade, but the other. The other man they both had known and loved. The woman looked at him for a long moment, trying to understand the words through the knife, the wind, the drowning rain. Then all of her memories caught up, from whatever distance they'd had to travel to reach her again.
Peanut butter, she finally said.
Transcendence doesn't ask us questions anymore now that Lucius has joined them. They have what they want. A god. A mascot. I wonder how long it'll take them to realize that Lucius can't inflict his own curse upon them any more effectively than any of their past prisoners were able to, despite his willingness to try. I wonder how long it'll take Lucius to realize there must have been others before him, but that they aren't here now. The morning after he left us, I woke to the sound of metal scraping, then a loud thud. My eyes snapped open to see everyone lying in a tangled heap on the far side of the cage. You're up, Ursula said when she saw me. Help us pull. Victor's belt was wrapped around one of the bars, its leather tail now dangling limply as it waited for them to grab on again. This is our plan to escape? I asked as I climbed to my feet. The point of force just needs to be more concentrated and the power greater, Ursula said. This is a lot better than each of us pulling on a different bar with only our hands. If the belt holds, Isabel added. As they passed our room on patrol, the soldiers watched us warily as we all took hold of the belt again. They didn't seem to think it was going to work, but they knew enough to know that when Shadowless got angry, sometimes other unintended things could happen. Go! Ursula cried. We all pulled, arms burning. The leather stretched. More! More! Motherfucker! Victor cried when the belt slipped and we all collapsed on top of him at full force.
This is as pointless as everything else we've tried, he gasped.
He's right, the woman in white said suddenly. I turned to see her floating through the main door to the abandoned church.
Are you here to give us breakfast or to proselytize? Ursula asked her. Because we're only interested in one of those things.
The woman stopped just in front of the cage. I want to spare you the wasted effort. You'll never be able to bend the bars. She bowed her head reverently. The Great One remembered long ago that they could never be destroyed. Nothing on earth can break them. As she said it, I suddenly knew it was true. I'd been able to feel it the moment we were locked inside. We all had, even though we'd refused to admit it to each other, but hadn't been able to describe it. The feeling that the bars were somehow more than bars. Now that she'd said it, I understood what it was. It was as if they were both the thing itself and the name for it. Perhaps simple poles of metal could be bent with enough force. But how would a person break an unbreakable bar? Ursula must have known it too, but she refused to show it.
The Great One. That's what you call Lucius now, she scoffed.
Oh, no, the woman said. The Great One was far more powerful, a queen among shadowless. She was the first we found, what we all aspire to be.
Is that so? Ursula asked. A shame you have to refer to her in the past tense, then.
She grinned, trying to provoke her.
Did she kill herself in some stupid accident because she didn't remember anything? This all-powerful queen of yours? Or did she commit suicide? To escape all of you?
The white woman's eyes narrowed, but she didn't say anything at first. Open the door, I prayed. Open the door and reach for Ursula. You'll never get it closed again. But she didn't. She finally looked away, and crouched down until her white layers rippled out into a small ivory lake. She looked at Zachary, who was still huddled on the ground, one sore arm from the fall tucked against his chest. "Are you all right?" she asked. She reached out and touched the back of his free hand softly. For once, he let her. He looked at her fingers, then slowly up at her face, into her eyes. "You have great power," she whispered to him, awed. "You've almost transcended." Ursula finally took a step toward her.
"Enough," she said. "He's fine."
The woman put her palms up and stood. "He's very important to you, isn't he?" she asked. Ursula didn't say anything. "He's important to us, too."
"Ha!" Ursula finally spat.
The woman in white looked at Zachary again.
"You don't have to fight," she said to him, almost as if praying. "You can choose to stop struggling. You're safe here. This is your home."
"This is not our home," I said.
"And New Orleans is."
The woman's eyes wrinkled above her veil.
"They are bandits there. Nothing more."
"How do you know?"
I started, but Ursula cut me off.
"Lucius," she said simply.
Of course they had asked him. He'd told them everything. Our journey. Our hopes. "He did it out of concern for you," the woman in white said. "You should know. Whatever you think is there, you've been misled."
"Don't listen," Ursula said to all of us. "She has no idea. She's lying."
The woman rose.
"Someday, very soon, you'll be able to see."
"You have no idea how long we can hang on," Ursula said.
"But I do."
She looked down almost hesitantly, as if she didn't want to say what followed.
"I've been instructed to stop feeding you."
"What?"
Victor roared. The lion tattoo on his arm looked just as angry as he was.
"You're going to starve us to death! What kind of people are you?"
"You won't starve. We won't let that happen," the woman said. "You'll join us before you do."
Ursula glared at her in silence. Transcendents were not shadowless, but they'd captured enough of us to know how the pull worked. How much faster fear or suffering made the forgetting come.
It was a foolproof plan. First, be kind. Offer food and protection from the outside world in the hopes that we might join them voluntarily. But if that fails, just wait until we forget they were the ones who put us in this cage in the first place. Then they would be our rescuers, not our captors.
The woman in white finally met our eyes again.
"Whether now or later, we'll welcome you all the same."
Victor threw the remains of his cigarette carton after her as she turned to leave, disgusted. The rest of us watched the guards remove the belt from the bars without protest. It wasn't worth the risk of injury or of accidentally forgetting something in the struggle. It was useless anyway.
"Give me until dawn,"
Ursula said at last, once things had calmed down.
"To what?" Isabel asked. "We can't break the cage. We've tried so many times already, and it's never even creaked once."
She ran her hands through her pale hair.
"I don't know if I have until dawn," she whispered. "I don't know if I can hang on that long anymore. And even if we do get out, what if that woman is right? What if there is no New Orleans after all, and we've been heading for nothing all this time?"
"Stop," Ursula said. "There is a New Orleans, and we are going there."
"Really?" I snapped, before I could stop myself. It was the first time I'd gone against her. It broke something in the rest of us. We began to fight, everyone yelling at everyone else.
Ursula turned to me in the chaos. Both of us looked on the verge of crying.
"It's going to be all right,"
she said gently over the roar. But it's not going to be all right, is it, Ori? Because if there isn't a New Orleans, or if we get there and it's not what we hope it is, then it would really be over. Everything I've done, the hope I've finally started to feel, all of it would be for nothing. I won't ever... There's no chance I... Shit! Ori, shit! I'm crying. I don't want you to hear me like this. I thought it was for the best, my love. Leaving home. You would know that by now if you could listen. I didn't want you to see me this way. I didn't want you to have to live with whatever was left. And if the worst thing happened, if I forgot you, I didn't want to be the reason that you died or disappeared, or turned into something that wasn't you. I couldn't be the reason. You would have done the same thing for me, and you know it.
When the arguing and crying had finally died away, Ursula came and sat by me in the corner of the cage.
Ori? His name is Ori, I whispered.
I know, she said. She nodded her chin toward where the recorder was hidden in my shirt.
I'm afraid to forget him, I admitted, ashamed.
You won't, Ursula insisted.
How can you know that?
Because I am going to get us out of here, she said firmly. And I'm going to get you to New Orleans before it's too late. I don't know how, but I will. I promise.
But the woman is telling the truth, isn't she? I asked. That the cage can't be bent.
Yes, Ursula finally said. But it doesn't matter. We've been going about it all wrong.
What do you mean?
She squeezed her hands around one of the bars, almost tenderly this time. Maybe we don't need to open it to escape. I could see her sifting through what was left of her mind, looking to see if she had the strength to do what she wanted, what she might give up if she succeeded. What we all might. Because even though Ursula was going to try and bear the brunt of whatever memories we might lose when she let the pool free to revolt against our captors, it was still going to take something from all of us. We wouldn't be listeners when she did it, but a chorus. Because whatever she wanted to do, it would cost too much for her alone to pay the price. We would have to harmonize, because to sing all of it alone would destroy her. Ursula looked at me again. Eyes determined. Just give me until dawn, she said. I didn't think I'd be able to sleep. I waited to see what would happen. But Ursula only sat quietly, eyes closed, as if in deep meditation. I kept expecting her to jump up and do something crazy, but she just kept sitting there, remembering, or trying not to. We were all already so exhausted, and without any food since the evening before, it was impossible to resist the numb cold of the cage's floor. I dozed, drifting a long time before I dreamed. It was the best dream, Ori. So warm and safe and peaceful. So real I could feel it. We were all back in the RV again. Some snuggled on the soft, worn couch, some stretched out lengthwise along the floor from back to front. Ursula was in the driver's seat, like she always is, one hand on the wheel and one on the gear shift, and I was reclining in the passenger seat, nestled into the cushions. Outside, a lone road stretched beneath the stars, a gentle curve across the dark, endless plains, and our tires rolled smoothly for once. So smoothly you could barely tell we were moving at all. Max, Ursula said softly to me from behind the wheel as I stirred. The night sky rolled by through the windshield. I need you to do something for me.
Sure.
I smiled drowsily.
I need you to hold on to the back of your seat as tightly as you can so you don't crack open your skull on the dashboard. I blinked. What? Right now, Max, Ursula said. Right now! My hands clawed at my headrest as the nose of the RV slammed through the heavy doors of the abandoned church in a pealing scream of splitting wood and crumbling bricks. The whole wall shattered, but it didn't matter. We burst through as it collapsed behind. We dropped over a ramp, maybe a short stack of stairs, and then suddenly the world opened back up. Ori! We were actually outside now, not just in my dream. Speeding beneath the dark starlit sky, crashing frantically through a maze of white tents and tiny twinkling torches as Ursula tried her best not to hit anyone or anything, but refusing to slow down, no matter what. What's happening? I yelled. But even as I did, I knew. I turned and stared open-mouthed at her. She had twisted Transcendence's power against them by giving them exactly what they wanted. She had forgotten. Forgotten that we'd been captive for days. That we weren't still free. In our RV, riding for New Orleans, and who knows what else. She hadn't tried to break the unbreakable bars of the cage because the woman in white was right. The Great One had remembered that the bars could never be broken. But she hadn't remembered anything about whether or not they could be changed. Ursula had transformed the cage into our RV, with us still inside. Everyone to the windows! She cried as she swung the wheel around another tent, past more torches where a mass gathering was being held, before some kind of giant altar. The followers all turned in slow motion, rows and rows of tiny ghosts, their veils floating in the breeze. I don't know who these people are, but they don't look friendly. Be ready to fight! Ilayo! Intisar cursed as she stared out the front from between us. There are hundreds of them! The RV pitched through a tent as white-robed figures dove out of the way, barefoot. Windows! Ursula ordered her. Behind us we could hear the roar of engines start up to begin their chase. The camp stretched out before us like a spiderweb, clustered and winding, some tents occupied and glowing softly with candlelight, others dark and lonely as their inhabitants milled outside. Pedestrians who had seen us racing toward them from afar had armed themselves with rocks, sticks, knives. They dashed at the sides of our RV now as it passed, trying to do some damage without being dragged underneath. Keep them away from the wheels! If we could just get outside of their lines and find a road, we might make it, I thought. We might outrun their scouts, who would have to return to their camp eventually, wouldn't they? There was no limit to how far we would go. Ursula jerked the gear shift, and we careened past something tall and boxy, sides smashed and corroding in the heat of a trash fire. Half a shipping container, I thought at first. But then I saw the molten, dripping tires, and the remnants of what had once been a painted mural across one of the surfaces. Only the sunset hadn't yet dehydrated and flaked into ash in the blistering heat of the flames. That's our RV. I watched it whisk by, too stunned to move at first. The real one, not our reimagined one. I stuck my head out the window to peer down the side of our vehicle as it raced jaggedly by. Only blank tan siding. Ursula's plan had been a success, but there was one fatal flaw. She had been the owner of the RV, or the one who found it, but not the one who painted our map. Her reimagining wasn't complete. The painting! I cried. We won't make it without the painting! Ursula's expression faltered for an instant as she realized I had named a thing that should have been there but couldn't remember why it wasn't. There were too many white-masked disciples streaming after us for her to consider it for more than a few seconds, though, or we'd die. Don't worry about that now, she shouted from the front seat. Just keep them away from us! I clambered to the other side to help Duho and Intisar hold off our pursuers. There was a knife in my hand. A knife with a dark green handle that hadn't been there before, I realized with dim horror. But there was nothing left to do now but thrust it out the window, slash and scream. Zachary was on the floor by our feet, his hands scrambling madly to pluck shapes out of thin air and then grasp them as solid things. He had heard me. He was trying to remember his brushes, so he could paint for us again. The soft stains on his fingers were darkening as they spread, creeping until the skin of his arms had turned into an inky swirl almost up to